Thanks. Yeah, so today I'm just going to be telling people about a bit about the Cosmological Collider Physics program. My assumption going in is that you will know what the standard model is, but nothing about cosmological collider physics. And so I will tell you basically everything you need to know, basically how to estimate Feynman diagrams and how to sort of what is the signature you're looking for in the sky and why you're looking for that. So I guess the place to start is basically, why is it called the Cosmological Collider Physics program? Like, why do people call that? And so to do that, sort of let's remind ourselves what is a regular collider. So at a normal collider, what happens is you take two things, you smash them really hard, you create some new particle. Basically everything we see nowadays is unstable, so we don't actually see the new particle. We see it decay, and we look at the decay products and try to reconstruct initial state, or this intermediate state, rather, sorry. And so it usually looks something like you have some falling background, and then you have some bump on top of it. And the location of the bump basically tells you what is this mass of the new particle, right? You're looking at some pole in some diagram. And basically, the size of the bump tells you how strongly coupled this guy is, right? Like, how easy it is to produce it. And so this is basically just the idea behind a regular collider. And so cosmological colliders are a little bit like a more restricted version of a normal collider, right? So in a normal collider, you get to crash stuff, you wait some time, you look at the decay products. So in the cosmological collider, you do the experiment has been done for us, which is great, but it's only been done once. And what we observe is actually only a single type of the final state decay products. In particular, the way we look for this is in the CMB. And you can ask, what does the CMB tell us? Well, if there's a hot spot in the CMB, what it's doing is basically saying that in that area of space, there are more inflatons, right? The inflaton bed was a little bit higher. It gave a slightly higher reheat temperature. And so the CMB there is slightly hotter. If there was a colder patch, it said there's slightly fewer inflatons there. And so what we're looking for in our final state is basically a distribution of inflatons in the sky, and only inflatons. So we have only a single final state that we're looking for. The way particles get produced is also a little bit different. So there are many ways to say it. One way to say it is, for example, that from our flat space perspective, the De Sitter space is sort of a hot bath at finite temperature of order Hubble. And so particles just sort of pop in and out of existence. They can sort of appear. And so the scattering initial point is not exactly a scattering of particles so much as just non-adiabatic production of particles. So that's the basic idea. And so the first thing to do is to ask, what is the analogy of this smoothly falling background here, right? Because first, before you look for something new, you have to see what is already there. And the statement is, this is the standard scale invariant power spectrum, right? You look at two points in the sky. They have, which is just the number of inflatons in one direction, number of inflatons in another, and just ask, how correlated are they? And it's just, the statement is, there's a basically a scale invariant, roughly speaking, Gaussian distribution. Okay, so that's sort of the smoothly falling background. So what happens if there's a new particle? Oh, and everyone should feel free to just interrupt in the middle. If I'm going too fast, you should just tell me. Okay, so just like at a regular collider, what happens if there is a new particle at this cosmological collider? And so the first thing you want to do is ask, well, where do we want to look for it? Well, you want to look in the place, just like a normal collider, with the least background possible. So for example, non-Gaussianities, right? In standard inflation, non-Gaussianities are small. And so a good place to look for new particles would be where there's zero, or not quite zero, but very little background, which is non-Gaussianities. So let's look there. So as before, you create a new particle.
Yeah, I think why not also yeah. look for Gaussianity is one thing, but there could be features in the spectrum as well, right?
So you could also look in the two-point function. The statement is just that because you already have the scaling invariant background there, it's a lot harder to find new features. It's also true that if you have any contact interaction for the inflaton, you don't mess with the two-point function.
There's plenty of examples where you do particle production.
Yeah.
You do particle production, which is motivated from the top down in certain ways. Even if the extra thing you interact with is quite heavy and couples quite directly. Mm-hmm. So it probably depends on like what subset of examples you have in mind.
Yeah.
What the cosmological collider sort of brand has seemed to come to mean is a lot of symmetry. So I'm not sure if that's what you have in mind, but like not allowing couplings directly between the inflaton and the other sectors, but requiring them to be derivative couplings, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I guess the statement, from my point of view, in terms of doing the inverse problem of doing like reconstructing things like the mass, it'll turn out that the three-point function is actually where the exciting part, like a direct measurement of the mass, lies. And I'll get to that like actually right now.
Well, but what couplings do you have in mind? Are there just derivative couplings or not? First of all,
I will be looking at derivative couplings, but they don't need to be for this. At this point, everything I'm saying will hopefully be general enough that it could be any sort of coupling.
Okay, I mean, but if there's not derivative couplings, stronger couplings, then there are other effects.
Yeah, then you'll have things like back reaction on the inflaton. There's going to be a lot of other effects that may actually you might see first, for example. Yeah. All right. Okay, so. Let's just look at a non-Gaussianity. So basically a three-point function, right? That's zero if something is completely Gaussian. Three-point function, so you're looking at three inflatons in the final state. And we're going to just have some creation process that creates a particle that then propagates and decays into other two. So how do we actually get the mass from this process? What is sort of the thing that pulls it out? And we can sort of get inspiration from a normal collider. So normally, if something propagates from here to there, you get the propagator, right? The 1 over p squared minus m squared. And that's literally what we're looking for at the collider, is that pull as you get close to dividing by zero. And so that comes from the propagator. So e to the I omega t is basically how we look almost always in general for particles. And so if something is created here and propagates over there, takes some time t, you get some phase e to the I times the energy times time. In De Sitter space, we basically always work in conformal time. So this is tau to the I times the mass. OK, so then the idea is sort of clear. You just measure this thing at different values of tau. And see, can you see this oscillation feature in there? If you do, then great, you've seen a particle. In fact, you could even Fourier transform this and look for a nice peak like we normally do in colliders. That's not exactly how we do it, but you could do it like that to make the analogy complete.
What do you mean by measure at different values of tau?
Excellent. That's the exact next slide. So what determines the time of these events, right? Because how do you make a measurement that's sensitive to one value of tau versus another value? And so let's get into this. So the first thing to do is to say, basically, what determines this value of particle production? And so, lots of times people will say that particles are sort of produced thermally in De Sitter space. The more accurate statement is that you get non-adiabatic production of particles, right? Because the wave number k is constantly expanding. And so your frequency is changing as a function of time. And so you get non-adiabatic production, right? The non-adiabatic theorem says whatever you're producing is hit by an e to the minus omega squared over omega dot. And if you just do the standard particle thing, right, omega squared equals k squared plus m squared, and then ask, what is the value at which this is minimized, so you get the least exponential suppression? It turns out that this is when k tau is of order 1, and the value is e to the minus m over h. So this fact is why people like to say De Sitter has the temperature of order Hubble, because this looks like a Boltzmann suppression. This thing is that the time is, roughly speaking, when k tau is of order the horizon scale. So basically, when things are exiting the horizon is when all the magic is happening. So hopefully, so if you talk to people about inflation, you'll typically hear a lot of these statements, and these are why the intuition for why it's the case. I guess I've already done it, but a lot of the time people in this literature set Hubble to 1, and so whenever you see an equation that doesn't quite make dimensional sense, it's because I set Hubble to 1.
Yeah, sorry to belabor this just one more time since you wrote it there. For a scenario where it's only derivatively coupled, you need the Mausdorff and Hubble. In general, that's not the case.
Yeah.
The Mausdorff could be quite different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Should I say that again?
I'm just repeating, I'm sorry. I tend to do that, but just the fact that if you have particles interacting with each other, not legislating that those interactions be derivative couplings,
right,
then there are other non-adiabatic effects than just this one.
Well, but even if it's derivative couplings, you get different effects as well. Right?
Well, that's probably also true. I'm just kind of going.
I mean, this is just gravitational. This doesn't have any derivative. If you just put a massive particle into sort of space, this is what happens, right?
Yeah. But I'm just saying the mass around Hubble is, in order for observable consequences, is not generally the case. But that just, I'm just harping on that lower right comment because I can't help myself. But
This is actually comes about, I put it a slide early in some sense.
Well, no, you don't need that if you want to consider particle production.
Yeah.
And effects.
Yeah, this is actually not associated with particle production. Statement is not associated with particle production, but more seeing the signature, which is why it's a few slides early.
Well, even that, but go
yeah. Okay, so if you say that the signature you're looking for is some oscillation in time, then we can go to conformal coordinates, but we had said that the tau of production and decay here are set by the momenta you're looking at. And so what you see is that what you want, the signature here, is to vary your momenta, k3 and k1, and then you should see that there's some oscillation here that has a frequency of order the energy of the particle, so in this case, the mass. You'll notice then that if you want to see as many oscillations as possible, this means that, one, you want this ratio to go from maybe like a small number to a large number, or a large number to even larger. So in other words, you're looking at the squeezed limit, where there's a hierarchy in scales between these guys. So that's the first thing to note, is that in this program, people are looking at the squeezed limit of non-Gaussianities. The second is to notice that experimentally, we don't have a huge range of K1s and K3s to look over. And so if you want an oscillation here, this oscillation should be of order 1 if you want it to be seen in data. So this oscillation frequency, which is mass over Hubble, should be of order 1. And so usually people are looking for this particular signature, are looking for particles with mass of order Hubble. Okay. So this is everything I just said. The cosmological collider program, I'd say, is looking at the squeezed limit of non-Gaussianities. The oscillations in K3 over K1 gives you the mass of the particle. And the magnitude of your non-Gaussianity tells you how strongly coupled the inflaton is to everything here. So in this sense, it is basically like a normal collider, where you're doing spectroscopy to give you the mass. You get the magnitude. The magnitude gives you the coupling. All right.
Sorry, maybe you said it, but what if the inflaton has self-interaction, so there would be additional diagrams contributing to the same
one? Yeah.
That would be a smaller effect.
So, no, it would not necessarily be a smaller effect.
So how would I know to distinguish if it's a new particle?
So if you have literally the inflaton itself, its non-Gaussian entities are suppressed by the slow roll parameter.
Right.
This is Huan's calculation.
Yeah.
You get F and Ls of order NS. And it's going to turn out if you put everything to the limit, these things can get you F and Ls much larger than that. And so you're just trying to take advantage of these things are not, these particles have nothing to do with slow roll, and so don't necessarily need to be hit by that.
What are the lines on your picture?
That's a good point. I never defined this. Thanks for saying. So the dotted lines are going to be the inflaton.
Okay.
And this solid line is just any other new particle.
So what is the interpretation of the bottom dot? I'm creating a pair of one inflaton and one...
Inflaton plus one. So this can't be, for example, a fermion due to this conservation of spin. So it would be a single scalar, or maybe like a gauge boson.
Something has to kinetic. So I need a mixing with the inflaton.
Yes, that's right.
That's right, at quadratical.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, you had that.
Yeah, so the dynamical range in the CMB is quite large, right? From L of a few to a few thousand. So what are the Ks that you're considering?
So an annoying fact is also that this is the non-analytic piece. There's going to be other factors of K3 over K1 that drive the signal to zero as you go to really high K.
So it's only
ratios.
Relatively low L.
And so you don't actually get a huge amount. Of modes. I don't remember exactly what ranges of M people have managed to explore. It's been really order one times Hubble. But with 21 centimeters, you get a lot more modes. You may be able to. But I think it depends a lot exactly on like derivative couplings here. We'll introduce more Ks that just lead to more suppressions and things like that. The statement of actually what's your exact range depends a lot on what your actual couplings are. So like I said, if there's a derivative here, it gets hit by K3 and your signal starts falling as you take K3 small and et cetera.
Yeah, people are talking about like a 10 to the 6 or something.
That's the number of modes, usually.
Okay, you're right.
So that's
just
not,
it's bound to the modes that I thought that's what Ken would ask.
But also there's an issue that we don't really know. So the current bounds on FNL are about 10. And in the squeeze limit, we hope in the next 5 to 10 years that it'll go down by an order of magnitude. So that's why I find this whole thing exciting, is because there's new data. Things will be improving on a relatively quick time scale. If you're super optimistic and like CMB, with 21 centimeters, you get a huge number of modes. And in principle, you could drive FNL down to like 10 to the minus 3 or something. But there's an issue of backgrounds and things like that, which people think occur around FNL of 1 or maybe 0.1. It's not entirely clear to me. And I don't think anyone knows how to get rid of those backgrounds. So taking all those modes are a bit optimistic because we don't really know what the background looks like or if we can subtract it or not.
So about the set interactions again, I mean, if you're saying that the set interactions are suppressed by slow parameters, which is true, I mean, and that coupling is derivative, but why is it not suppressed by slower parameters?
So if it was not a derivative, it would be hit by slow roll. But if it's a derivative, then it's not hit by slow roll because derivative interactions don't mess with your potential at all. Right, because there's a shift symmetry if there's a d mu phi. And so then,
you're going to have a phi dot, which is a slower suppressed again, no?
I'll get to that later. But the statement is, phi dot is slow roll suppressed as compared to the total energy, so Hubble times M Planck. Mm-hmm. The fact that there's an M Planck in there means that it's actually, phi dot is actually rather large if you're comparing it to things, let's say, like Hubble. And so you'll find that as long as this suppression scale is not 1 over M Planck,
phi dot can be large
compared to Hubble squared.
It's a symmetry breaking scale.
Yeah.
So coming back to the self-interaction, just one more comment. I mean, everybody knows that with ones that do inflation but aren't consistent with slow roll, those can exist, but they have a different shape of non-Gaussianity.
Yeah.
So that would be how you distinguish. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so here this is really only in the squeeze limit. And in fact, it may not even be the first way you discover these models. Like, as you say, there may be like large equilateral configurations and whatnot. And so depending on the exact model, you may find it well earlier in some other way, and then this would be
they're
something else.
Typically large equilateral configurations.
Yeah.
For the propagator, if I have ways for this particle, how that enters into the calculation? Because it's decay, right? Eventually.
Yeah.
So there is a ways. Mm-hmm. So that will change the IN to...
So plus I gamma type things. Yeah.
Become like a decaying, whatever. Mm-hmm. All that changes the calculation.
I would say all you do is you do plus I gamma here.
But gamma compared to the mice has x to I, so that will become a...
Yeah, so it'll just be a suppression of your signal as you go to higher and higher.
Change the amplitude.
Or higher ratios, yeah.
So I don't know if this is the right time to ask, but I guess one of the motivations for the cosmological collider regime and all that is to understand how like bulk unitarity appears, you know, things like how the cutting mm-hmm. rules and whatnot.
Yeah, so I'm not going to address at all that aspect of the whole thing. This is, in some sense, going to be completely phenomenological.
Fair enough.
Yeah, so what motivates me to even think about this is just the statement that bounds on FNL are increasing by order of magnitude or more on a rather short time scale. So I want to see basically what are some, if I'm optimistic and you see something, like what sort of things might you see?
And you're going to discuss what the amplitude of this is?
Yes. All right. Okay. All right, so people have sort of brought this up a bit. Some of the issues you might have with this sort of thing in particular is you basically get two pieces of information. You get the mass and the coupling. And it's rather easy just to throw in any new particle with some mass and some coupling into any theory. Two is it turns out non-Gaussian entities tend to be small, right? Just for example, the inflaton has an FNL of 0.1 or something. And so that's pretty hard to look for. And the other is that it probes masses of order Hubble. When we were first thinking about this, we actually did not try to solve any of these problems. But it turns out that if you just ask, like, what is the sort of minimal coupling of the standard model to a shift symmetric inflaton, it actually ameliorates all of these problems to some extent. And so, basically, the idea here is just say, well, we're looking for new particles. What if it was an old particle? What if it was something in the standard model? So the new particle we're looking for is a standard model particle. It'll turn out both the mass and coupling constant will be determined by a single interaction. So what we're going to do is we're going to add only a single interaction. And surprisingly, it'll determine exactly the mass and the coupling of the particle involved, of the standard model particle involved. And the interaction is going to be the most relevant operator allowed by symmetries connecting a shift symmetric inflaton to the standard model. All right, so let's say we want to couple a shift symmetric inflaton to the standard model. What are the leading order relevant operators? So you can either have a current interaction, d mu phi coupling to some current, or you can couple to some gauge bosons via the topological term. So it turns out that this guy already has pretty tight constraints on it. This thing produces new particles or gauge bosons really, really efficiently. And if you have this during inflation, it is, for most values, it's already actually excluded. So I'm actually not going to talk about this guy here.
That's a really interesting statement. Maybe you don't want to explain because it's remedial, but you're saying...
So the reason why this thing...
could be some hidden sector.
Yeah.
That kind. We know it. What's the approximate cause of that statement?
Which statement?
Just what's the leading constraint? I mean, where is the leading constraint coming from?
One thing, for example, is let's say you put the standard model photon here or something.
Okay.
Uh-huh. If you do the dispersion relationship for the photon here, it turns out there's a tachyonic mode. Uh-huh. So you just get exponential production of gauge bosons. And this can actually cause suck out order one energy from the inflaton.
So it can, and it typically does in some sense. I mean, I know there's a lot of work on this.
it depends a bit on what you think a reasonable value of lambda here is.
Right, that's kind of what
but the statement is, if you put in some things, let's say like the gut scale, it actually has the option of, well, when it was originally proposed, people actually thought of using this to give you slow roll. Is you just have particle production, and that slows the particle down. And it was perfectly viable at the time, but which was, I guess, 20-some years ago. But since then, data has just excluded those things, those approaches.
It was never viable, right? Those models were just... So I think if you're referring to the
Sorbo type,
I think it ends up just being very, very non-Gaussian. So you have to add 10 to the 5 gauge scales to get it to work.
Okay.
It's just, you're shooting photons at the inputon, right? So that's just going to be result in a very non-Gaussian distribution of fluctuations. And so then you add 10 to the 5 of these things by the central limit theorem to get you back to a Gaussian distribution. And then the issue is that the spectrum ends up being blue because phi dot increases, so the exponential just goes the wrong way.
So those models were almost dead on arrival?
I think they were out.
Okay.
I don't know that they were ever viable. And then,
okay.
But that's my read on it, but that may just reflect my own bias. Yeah.
Okay. Well, either way, I'm not going to talk about them, since they can be...
Right. Although, for you, though, you weren't thinking of any additional mechanism. You were thinking slow roll as the mechanism.
No, we were just assuming...
Because we're not in the regime where...
It has any back... Yeah,
it would apply. So, anyway.
Yeah, so in some sense, it's just a choice that I choose not to look at these guys. If you forbid them at tree level, they're connected to anomalies, so they don't appear until... things, let's say, you get other things more like box phi and whatnot. But let's look at this other guy instead. So we're going to look at a coupling of a fermion derivatively to a scalar.
Sorry, why the gamma 5 there?
Because if it's not a gamma 5, it's a conserved current. You can integrate by parts and it's zero. And so it has no effect. Okay, so we can rewrite this operator as coupling to some J mu. And so, as everyone knows, the inflaton solves the things like the horizon problem and whatnot. So the gradients are exponentially small, but the time derivatives can actually be fairly large. Well, I'll explain what I mean by large with respect to what later. But either way, the zeroth order statement is this thing looks more like a phi dot J zero. And if you think way back until back to StatMech, when something couples to a charge, it's usually called the chemical potential mu. And so the leading order coupling of the inflaton to the standard model is a chemical potential for spin here. And so there are two things then to say is, one, what is the effect of this chemical potential for spin? And two, how large can it be? So the first thing is, how large can it be? And so in order to have a consistent EFT, my phi dot has to be smaller than lambda squared, the sort of UV cutoff squared, because I'm doing an expansion in d mu phi over lambda squared. And you can say, well, my chemical potential is equal to phi dot over lambda. Do a little bit of math. You see you get something that's of order 1, a slow roll parameter here, and it turns out to be about 60 Hubbles. Note that this has nothing to do with 60 E-foldings. It's just a coincidence that you got 60 here. So the chemical potential can actually be large with respect to Hubble and still be having a consistent EFT here. Okay, so the second question then is, what is the effect of this chemical potential? The statement is, it modifies your dispersion relationship to look like something like this, where in particular, this plus or minus sign is determined by if you're spin up or spin down. So let's say you're spin up, you get a plus sign, spin down, you get a minus sign. Unfortunately, people who have looked at this before and sort of set the nomenclature, for some reason call this guy lambda instead of a chemical potential, since that's literally what it is. So I apologize for the change in notation.
Well, but it's not quite a chemical potential. The chemical potential is something that shows up when the Hamiltonian is phi dot.
Yeah, that's right.
If you do the complete Legendre transformation, that term actually ends up dropping out. So I think it's...
Yeah, it's...
We can argue later about it, but it's... Mm-hmm.
That's true. Okay, so as before, the way to think about particle production in De Sitter space is through the 980 Batic theorem. In particular, again, we do the same thing we had before. Production of particles is of order e to the minus energy squared over omega dot. We can say, well, if this is a plus sign, this thing is always exponentially suppressed. But if there's a minus sign here, you notice that when k is of order lambda, it shoots down very quickly. And so omega dot here is maximized when k is of order lambda. And so if you work through this, what you find is that minimizing, or this guy here, gives you e to the minus m squared over lambda times Hubble at a value of k tau about the chemical potential. So in other words, this process is no longer completely dominated by the particle production is not happening at Hubble. It's happening at more like something like 60 Hubble, let's say. So that's slightly different from the normal case. And you'll notice that even if your mass is much larger than Hubble, if your chemical potential is large, you can beat down this exponential. And so you won't actually get the suppression you normally get hit of e to the minus m over h that kills you. Yeah?
It's a stupid question, but what is actually p meant to represent?
So I guess the statement is going to be the number density of particles produced is going to scale as e to the minus omega squared over omega. Yeah, the number density. Let's say, because this is going to be some equilibrium process, let's say. Yeah, because this is not like something that happens once, twice, whatever. It's just constantly happening. So, yeah, so it's better to think of this. I probably should have just said number density here.
And this is like a rough estimate, which is a reasonable.
Yes, that's right.
One can compute it.
I'm going to show you the results of actual calculations later, but I want to skip all actual calculations because they involve very messy hypergeometric functions and like six integrals over them, which we had trouble. We couldn't even do numerically, and so we had to do approximations. And the approximations are actually motivated by these sorts of physical interpretations. But yeah. So the hope here is just to give people an idea of how things scale. That's it. All right, was there another question? Okay. So, all right, so you can then ask, so very soon I'm actually going to start getting to physics rather than just sort of estimates of how things work. But how does the number density of particles scale? Well, it has this exponential factor, which I, for some reason, didn't write down here. But right, the number density tends to be k squared times delta k. We had just said k is of order your chemical potential, lambda. So, and delta k is set by this mass term. So as when the mass term is very large, you get a large swath. But if it's very small, it shoots through zero very quickly. Or not quite to zero, but it's a small very quickly. And so it turns out if you ask, what is the range of k for which you get this exponential suppression, it's only of order m, at least in the small mass limit. And so, all right, so now that we actually have an idea of what this effect does, let's try to see what are its signals, sort of how does this whole thing work. And so you have a number density of particle that's of order the mass of the particle times the coupling constant squared. And so you have, let's say, the particle you're coupling to is the top quark. It can couple to any of the fermions in the standard model, but the top quark will have the largest effect.
Sorry, just I'm sure you said this, but you're not doing some scenario where the Higgs is the inflaton here. You're doing something coupled to...
Just say standard model is a complete spectator to inflation. Yeah. All right. So we have some number of top quarks. However, you'll remember that if you have some number of top quarks, you affect the Higgs potential, right? this is sort of, actually, Eva even brought this up yesterday, if you have a number density, you multiply by the mass, and you add that to your potential, roughly speaking. Right? And so you would expect that this number density changes the Higgs potential by some finite density effects. The Higgs potential is what determines the top quark mass, though. And so that also, in turn, determines the number of quarks. And so you have this very nice cyclic relationship here, where everything depends on everything else, and there's only going to be one solution. So you can actually go through an annoying in-in calculation to calculate the correction to the potential of the Higgs. I'm not going to tell you any details other than saying it's super messy.
Well, sorry, strictly speaking, it's not a potential per se. It doesn't have that equation of state at some energy density, but it does depend on
yeah.
the Higgs.
Yeah, it's some finite density contribution to the potential.
So when you write VH, you mean that?
Yeah, that's right.
Sorry, we have produced particle, antiparticle here. We
yeah.
produce both, right?
Yep.
Just curious, the finite density, maybe, does that care? Feedback to the Higgs, does that care about the particle and antiparticle?
No, because you can say, let's work in the non-relativistic limit. If I have five top quarks and five anti-top quarks, and I double the top quark mass, that will then double the energy, right? It doesn't, the mass is always m top regardless of whether or not it's a particle or an antiparticle. Yeah. So I had said I'd only done one change to the standard model, which was the leading order coupling. So you don't change any of this. These guys are the ones we have measured at low energy colliders. In particular, this is some 100 GeV squared type number. And so compared to both of these guys, compared to this whopping scale Hubble squared effect are basically negligible. And so the minimum of the Higgs is basically determined entirely by the finite density effects. And so you can go through, calculate what's the BEV of the Higgs, or you'll notice that it always appears as Y top squared Higgs, Y top squared Higgs squared. And so what you're actually doing is determining the mass of the top quark. You determine that, see that it's exactly determined up to pi's in terms of the coupling constant to the inflaton.
Sorry, I'm still catching up with Eva. What is VH here?
It is the finite density effect contribution to the Higgs potential.
You could think of it maybe as the TT component of the stress energy tensor.
Yeah.
Okay, that's more helpful. Thanks.
I guess we don't want to go there, but the other day I was explaining that for scalars like pi squared, chi squared, that ends up being linear.
Yeah.
The variance of chi ends up scaling like 1 over 5, so chi squared, pi squared, linear.
Mm-hmm.
Here you have a quadratic, so I would have to think about...
Quadratic appears because the number density also depends on the mass, which... Yeah, and so that's just because it's a different coupling doing everything. And so the scalings are going to be slightly different.
It's fermions also.
Yeah. Okay. All right, so because you have the finite density effect here, you've determined the mass of the top quark to be basically just square root your coupling. So you have a single mass that's determined by your coupling, and your coupling also determines the amplitude. And so your two measurements that you can make are actually exactly determined in terms of each other. So you can actually test this model, which is nice, because everything is determined by a single parameter. So what about the signature of this in non-Gaussianities? So again, we're looking at a three-point function, three inflatons here, and you can ask, How do you even connect this diagram? Well, with fermions here, you have to do a loop, right? Conservation of spin doesn't let you write a single fermion going from here to there. And so this integral is messy, so I'm not going to tell you anything about its calculation. I'm just going to present you with the result of this. I don't know why the conventions are the way they are, But a lot of the times when talking about this, people write everything in terms of the shape parameter, which is just you take your three-point function, you take some fixed scalings of k away, you take away some two-point function piece, and this is what people like to talk about for some reason. But either way, I told you sort of how to estimate the three-point function. And what you end up getting is something that looks like this. So let's try to actually understand this scaling. The first is you have a fermion loop. So a loop of fermions is just a number density, right? The expectation value of psi bar psi. And so you get the number density here, which is m lambda squared with the exponential. You have this guy here, which is just the coupling constant cubed. You have a mass squared here because, okay, what's the best way to put it is, well, the coupling constant you're looking at can be integrated by parts and gives you mass terms. And if you're working in the small mass limit, you basically have something that looks like this being your leading order diagram. And so that's two mass insertions, so only m squared. There are two pieces here. Here, there's a 2 times I omega. 2 because now there are 2 fermions propagating instead of 1. And otherwise, it's the standard oscillation we mentioned before of e to the I omega t. Here, the 2 can be thought of as you have psi bar psi diluting away as you go from here to here. And so you get an a cubed dilution factor. Because of how things are defined, it turns out that a cubed just turns into a squared. But that just has to do with how you went from the three-point function to this s.
So I just have some things that seem very confusing here. So if I, because the top part will decay if the weight is non-zero. So I think if I produce a bunch of high density top quark, but if the decay time, let's say, make that infinity short, so they decay promptly, so the back reaction to the Higgs potential will be gone. So I will not see the enhanced Higgs wave. If the top quark just decay, you produce, then you decay, then you don't feed back the final density. I would say that the decay width of the top quark should enter into the estimation, but I have not seen that. So far, I can see.
Well, we're looking for an equilibrium configuration. And so as long as the decay rate is slower than Hubble, you don't really care.
So maybe that's a way to...
Because Hubble expansion is more of a dilution factor than the decay.
But the decay width is maybe 1 over...
So if the mass is of order Hubble, or 3 times Hubble, the decay width of the top is not within a factor of 3 of its mass, right?
It's just 1 over pi.
That's smaller than 3, or 1/3. So it's still smaller than Hubble. So Hubble is still the major dilution factor here, right? So right, in general, people, when talking about this, don't talk about the dilution or the decays, because if you're looking for a particle with mass of order Hubble, in order for the decay width to be important, it needs the decay width of order Hubble as well, which is then, if your theory is perturbative, that's never the case.
But it's just a subleading shift to 2.
Yeah, that's right. It's a subleading shift to 2. That's right. You can do plus I gamma here and then get that all in. Yeah, that's right. Okay. So this is how it scales, and if you just do this whole thing partially numerically, I don't think anyone has ever been able to do this entire thing completely numerically or completely analytically. You have to do some approximations. But if you do a few approximations based on, let's say, like the squeezed limit, knowing that k tau of order lambda is where everything is dominated, you can then calculate it. And what you get is something that scales, as I wrote before, in the small mass region, and then decays exponentially like I mentioned before, in the large mass region.
How big? So yeah, this is the squeeze limit. How big is the equilateral contribution?
So you'll notice that there's a squared here. So the equilateral contribution we expect is going to be, if you take this to be, let's say, 10, about a factor of like 100 larger or something, if you're taking K3 over K1 to be 10. But I mean,
this is only valid in
this. But this particular equation is only valid in that limit. Yeah.
I was curious.
But yeah, you're going to get a larger effect at the squeezed or at the equilateral than at the squeezed, or at least sort of. Yeah.
So I mean, sorry. Okay. So some of this is ruled out.
So for example. FNLs of order 10 and above are already ruled out for sure. The bounds on equilateral configurations are actually, from people I've talked to, seem to say that they're not going to be getting better, even though the squeeze limit is.
Well, we've got to be careful, right?
But
this oscillates, so what's being constrained is scale invariant.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, is it obvious that the
No, but
if I start summing modes, this is going to start canceling.
Sure,
it's not obvious that if I don't use the right template, then I'm going to pick this up.
I agree it's not obvious, but it's not obvious either way, right? So
exactly. The projections are very complicated. So.
Yeah, I think some people at Harvard are looking into this, like Xingang and others. I don't really, for some reason, I don't remember the results that they quoted. Sorry about that. But perhaps the more useful way of plotting this is you have one parameter, which is your coupling, and your FNL as a function of that one parameter. And you can see you can definitely get why your perturbation theory is still valid, but sort of in some sense barely so, right? You can get to really large FNLs and have it actually be excluded. But you can see that if you want, let's say, FNLs of order 1, it's, let's say, like 0.1 expansion parameter. So you have to decide how happy you are with that sort of coincidence of scales of phi dot and lambda squared being within a factor of 10 of each other. But at least there is some region of parameter space where it can actually be seen in the future.
But this is the amplitude of the oscillations in FNL.
Yes, that's right.
And so can you remind me what was the expected kind of period in K for those oscillations?
Of order, so usually people like to just choose a value that's of order 1. So masses of order Hubble. So that as you, let's say, double the value of K, the ratio K3 over K1, you'll see like sort of one oscillation roughly.
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be in CMB context, I would think that's a pretty, when we consider the range of modes that we constrain FNL on.
Yeah.
And, to get the Planck bounds, let's say we want Planck's naive, FNL less than 5-ish.
Mm-hmm.
That's using all the modes of Planck.
Yeah. And so to actually constrain models like this, you need to actually have a template with an oscillating thing, fit it, and then do that. I was just saying that as ballpark type numbers people talk about.
Okay. But I shouldn't like draw the Planck FNL.
Yeah, so that's why I didn't actually draw a line here or anything.
Okay.
It's just sort of to guide your eye. What the hope is that if you had the proper, did everything properly, had the exact correct templates, that maybe you'd get similar values to what we have now, where FNLs are varying anywhere between 1 and 100, I guess. In terms of the actual constraint, depending on the shape.
I'm worried about these templates because the minute you start constraining how many modes you look at, your FNL bounds, and I've looked
it's
at some kind
worse,
of
yeah.
The context of scale dependent on Gaussianity and how limited we are if we like say we only have non-Gaussianity for really large scales. The bounds on FNL go up real fast the minute you start. And this was the major reason why the bounds on FNL got so much better between WMF and Planck. It was just more scales. If you're restricting yourself, that I'm only looking at a very limited range of scales, I think constrained is you
can. Why would this limited? Like you have like some oscillating pattern, right? Like where you can still look at it okay. Like you just fit it.
Right, but I mean, you need to know. I guess you. I guess I'm just curious. Even if you're like doing some kind of template filter that you're looking for an oscillating FNL, you know, the scale, what the actual bound on that amplitude would be.
The amplitude is correlated with the frequency. Yeah.
The amplitude is correlated with the frequency.
It's M, it's the same M above. Right?
So you're saying if you do the mesh filter right, you think you get, I'm just trying to get an estimate of your FNL 10, FNL 100.
So you have to scan over the frequency, at least another version of this, and that's the price you pay, plus resolution is bad if it's too short.
And the Lokowska is horrible as well.
Yeah, but there are bounds that are meaningful on different kinds of oscillatory signatures as it is, and I mean they're not overwhelming, but they exist and they will improve. By the way, with your comment about equilateral definitely not getting better, my understanding vaguely was that, well, you know how there was recently independent analyses of cosmological parameters using large-scale structure essentially alone, and they get, you know, Hubble competitively with CMD and they agree with CMD and so on. In that context, my understanding was it's an open question how well it would do. Like, it did pretty well on the cosmological parameters of the ones that are known. And so I thought it was an open question how well that kind of exercise will do with equilateral.
Yeah, I guess I was basically told there are backgrounds, so you have to be careful.
You do.
And so that was basically, I don't really know how careful people have to be and whatnot. So I don't actually know how much better it'll be getting.
Yeah, I don't think it's known, but the point is it's not known one way or the other, for sure. Yeah.
And I guess FNLs, those backgrounds tend to appear somewhere between squeeze limit, they tend to appear between 0.1 and 1. They also don't know exactly when and how they'll improve beyond that when that happens, so. Yeah, it's an open question, most of this, since this is still, in some sense, a very young field. Yeah. Okay. Anything else? All right, so these were the things I had mentioned before that people, when they usually tell them about things like cosmological collider physics, what are sort of the first three concerns people bring up. And sort of all these, by, in some sense, chance, are mitigated actually by the fermion couplings. In the standard model, it turns out mass and couplings are related. The non-Gaussianities tend to be small. Actually, that's really only the case if you look at, for example, like just the inflaton by itself, very simple deformations tend to give rather large non-Gaussianities. And you'll notice that we don't only probe masses of order Hubble anymore, because instead of e to the minus m over h, which normally kills you as you go to large m, you have m squared over lambda h, so you're gaining a factor of 60 or so. So at least you have an order of magnitude spread, maybe two if you round up, and masses that you can probe. Okay, let's see, I have only 5 minutes. So I will basically maybe just jump to the slide where we talk about the signal. So the idea here is just saying, well, we were only talking about standard model fermions. You can also talk about the standard model Higgs. And in particular, if you trust the current values of the standard model Higgs and take nothing between here and a large scale, the Higgs potential actually turns over and there is another minimum. And so the question is, well, what if during inflation the Higgs sort of random walked its way over there? And so can you actually test what happens if the Higgs is actually in another minimum during inflation? And the answer is you can sort of do it, because even though cosmological collider physics probes masses of order Hubble, there's a large number of masses in the standard model that span many decades. So if the Higgs mass is thrown up to the gut scale or something, by chance, it's likely that there is going to be a mass of a fermion near Hubble. And so what we did was just say, look at that case, and look at any of the fermions in the standard model. And let's see, on the y-axis, we have sort of the VEV. And the shaded lines here are basically increasing values of F and L. So the lighter it is, between 1 and 10, gets a little darker to 10 and 100. And very near the edge, you can get F and L's of order 100. And so you can see that if you choose a value of the Higgs VEV, let's say like right here, you can see both, in this case, what is, I hit the strange and the muon, strange quark and the muon. And so you actually, you might see two oscillatory features, and by taking ratios, you actually know those ratios of mass should be the ratios of the Yukawas in the standard model. And you might actually try to say, oh, these new fermions we're seeing are actually the standard model fermions because the ratio of masses happen to match exactly what the standard model would say. And so it may be true that you could even sort of test what happens if the Higgs was in a different minimum during inflation, even if that minimum was far away from the Hubble scale, just because fermion masses scan so many decades of mass. All right, so let's conclude.
It's like you mean that, so in the standard model, though, it's just unstable, though, right?
So runs away and then generally speaking, unbound theories that are unbounded from below behave really poorly. So we assume that something actually stabilizes it. Let's say, something stabilizes it. Let's say higher dimensional operators near the Planck scale, near the Gut scale. And so that will just basically determine what the value of the Higgs VEV actually is here. In the end, what really matters is always ratios of any dimensionful scale to Hubble, which is why I wrote it in terms of Hubble rather than writing some absolute scale.
So do you guys also address, if we get into that lower, large Higgs value, how we come back?
So one of the great things is that at finite temperature, there's a large Higgs mass at the origin. And so if you have very efficient reheating, you can even pull that up and have that sort of beat out your quartic term.
It's not technically true that this really just goes like VUV over Hubble, right? Because the Yukawa will run. Over.
Yeah, so that's a dirty secret here, which is this is really RG runnings of the Yukawa couplings. And so it's not exactly true. If you just see a ratio, you don't know it's like at what ratio should it be, right? Like, let's say you're a gut person, you believe in B tau unification or something. That just shows two things that are different in the IR could be the same up here. And so, yeah, it's there. This definitely has a lot more fuzz that you can play around with. And
there's just a log of 10 to the 5 in this
Yeah.
Plot, right? The answers can change.
By a lot. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. All right. So personally, I think sort of this the idea of cosmological collider physics is exciting because it gives us access to new high energies. And perhaps just as importantly, bounds on F and L are getting better on very reasonable timescales. So that's at least worth thinking about what we might see if we're optimistic. We basically see the mass and the couplings of new particles. Surprisingly, the minimal situation is actually very predictive. Of course, you can always add in more couplings and then break every relationship. But at least the leading order one is actually kind of predictive and kind of cute. And modulo various assumptions, you can even sort of probe new minima where the Higgs mass is very large, or Higgs VEV in particular is particularly large. All right. Any other questions?
I mean, as you were saying earlier, like in the standard model, you know, the Higgs doesn't have, you know, the second minimum, like, I don't know, 10 to the 16 or something.
Yeah.
So presumably you're already altering the standard model in some way, and my question is, I mean, presumably there are going to be other, you know, other signatures of such a deviation from the standard model that may have nothing to do with the same B.
Yes.
And so...
Yeah, I agree. Like, the whole thing of saying there's nothing up until the Hubble scale is kind of a sketchy assumption. It's a common one, but it's kind of sketchy.
No, but I guess my question is, like, you know, there may be other implications of such a you know, beyond the standard model theory, right? And mm-hmm. presumably some of those could actually rule out some of the parameter space you're talking about, maybe not.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
And so I guess the statement is just that's very model dependent. And so here we're just trying to say what are some generic signatures you could look for. It's definitely true you can, and they're not true for all models. And so I'd just say these are sort of maybe the zeroth order things you first look at, since that's what we were doing here, is very zeroth order. What are the first things you can expect? And yeah.
In your first example with the top quark, you ignored the zero temperature Higgs potential, right?
Yes.
It's not, can you explain to me why you can ignore the quark?
It just turns out that if the quartic is, there is an expansion you can do. Let's see if, where is it? Okay. Let me remember what the exact expansion parameter is.
Hubble is 1 here, right?
Yeah, Hubble is 1.
So it's quartic over like all of the
covers. Yeah, so there's, I guess the dominant thing here is the 6D. Coupling. So it's basically the fact that the quartic coupling is not like getting close to 1 or 4 pi.
60 was already ruled out, right? It had to be like less than
yeah.
30 or something mm-hmm. like that, or 20.
Yeah.
That ratio is roughly like 1%. Like for everything
yeah.
But if it is stable, I mean, if it could be stable, there could be higher order terms in the Higgs potential that make it steeper.
Yeah, that's right. So if there was, so these two guys by itself don't work. But for example, one way to break all this is add the Ricci scalar coupling to the Higgs. That gives plus h squared Higgs squared comparable to this piece. I guess maybe with the 60, it's not quite, you have to choose larger than order one couplings. But that's, for example, one way you could break the relationship. You could add higher dimensional operators that become very important really close to the Hubble scale. Yeah, so in some sense, what we did was we said the minimal Higgs quartic by itself is too small. And
if
we just assume there's nothing else, we would just investigate the effects of just a single coupling. Then this is true, but definitely once you have more than one coupling, everything can break. Yeah.
Is there any fruit to be found by trying to unify these couplings to an idea of reheating? I mean, if you're going to be coupling the inflaton to the standard model, a big motivation to do that is to get rid of the inflaton and reheat after inflation. Do you envision that these are the same couplings that you...
They actually can lead to fairly efficient reheating.
Okay.
And so they can literally be the coupling that does reheating.
Is there any kind of... Can you give me a sense of the complementarity of the bounds that you hope to put on these couplings from FNL? What those bounds could imply for reheating?
We would need to get a measurement of R in some sense, because all this does a lot of the time is... It tells you everything in units of Hubble.
Right.
And so you need to get that overall dimension nailed down.
Okay.
And so if you got R and you saw this, then you could just say this is reheat temperature is this or larger if there's some other thing making it.
Then so what values of H do you sort of have in mind? Because I mean lambda's negative if you go above like 12 or something like that. So.
Mm-hmm. And I mean it turns out this guy here, for example, will go down and then back up. And so even if you take Hubble of order, let's say near the energies of order of the gut scale, so near the current bound, this negative quartic coupling doesn't actually destabilize this minimum. Yeah. It'll cause this thing down here to turn over. And so then you might worry that you could tunnel or something
But it's really about the height of the barrier, though, right? Because I mean, stochastic.
Yeah.
The Higgs is just going to
be. The height of the barrier will be larger than.
So normally.
Will be larger than h to the fourth because as long as lambda here is some 10-ish number times Hubble.
Because normally the story is if I forget about the fermions, then the Higgs just stochastically just wanders out.
Right? Yeah, that's right.
And then I have a problem if I go too much above like 10 to the 12 GeV because then there's some finite probability that I
just run over.
Ends up in ADS space or something.
That minimum is very deep.
Yeah, so
that minimum is much
it's deep because let's say you put a 60 type number here.
Yeah.
60 times, well, so that's like 1,000 type times Hubble. And so that's sort of the type of number that will walk into your probability of tunneling from here to there through the barrier. And so it is true, though, if this lambda was small, let's say like Hubble over 5 or something, then you definitely start worrying about things like that. But also, that's not where we would actually be able to see a signal as well. In some sense, the fact that we can only see a signal when the coupling is large is also what stops you from being able to run over the barrier.
But so what is the depth of this compared to Higgs?
To Hubble? It's about a factor of 1,000.
So what is the Higgs doing during inflation? Your picture?
Oh, so if the mass is about of order 1,000 times Hubble, it's not random walking at all. It's just nailed to its minimum. Right.
But then that's a big negative energy density.
So then...
How do I square that with the fact that I'm supposed to be in the oscilloscope?
Because this is a large energy density compared to Hubble to the fourth, but not to Hubble squared and Planck squared, which is the inflaton. And so its back reaction on the inflaton is small, because I'm assuming the inflaton is dominating everything. Yeah?
What happens... So during inflation, that's fine, but during reheating, this would be a problem.
So during reheating, if you have fast reheating, then T to the fourth is of order H squared and Planck squared, and so T to the fourth is larger than this. So T to the fourth has the possibility of throwing you back towards the origin.
If it's
fast, yeah.
At that point,
yeah.
Faster than Hubble.
Mm-hmm. That's right. But there, it is true, like you say, that you may worry because this has a large negative CC, that it would cause problems if the reheating was not fast enough.
If we don't reheat very fast, then like the fermions will go away.
Dilute away, yeah.
This potential is there only because of the fermion density. Like, once the inflation stops, like this
yeah, in some sense, in some sense, putting this below zero is not quite right. You should just lift everything up by a bit, because the energy density of a finite number of particles is always positive. So it's actually not even ever putting you towards ADS, since this is more a finite density effect. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I'm worried about the inflaton coupled to the fermion. Do you have a sense how large what's the range of the lambda F, which can give you a signal, and also
It's going to be of order tens of Hubble. Yeah, let's say like an order of magnitude around there.
So we throw out the gauge bosons because they develop the tachyon motor. Can it be a similar effect from a non-minimal coupling of the inflaton to gravitons?
So the issue with phi RR tilde couplings is when you expand gravity, there's a lot of 1 over m Plancks that appear. And so you get a lot of like frequency over m Planck. So that's, let's say, frequencies of order Hubble. So that's a lot of 2 more Hubble over m Planck squared. That just causes everything to be way too slow to be of interest, usually. I think people have used that coupling to deal with things, let's say, like baryogenesis, where you have a 10 to the minus 10 type thing effect that you're interested in. So I think Michael Peskin wrote some paper using that coupling to do that. But if you want some like order one in your face effect, it's you have too many 1 over m Plancks.
The exponential tachyonic production doesn't?
Because exponential tachyonic only is effective if it's faster than Hubble.
I see. Okay.
Otherwise, it just gets diluted away faster than it can grow.
Maybe one comment or doubt. I'm sorry I missed the seminar because I had a telecom, but I don't know the depth of what you've been speaking, but about reheating, mm-hmm. I mean, it really depends how you produce the thermal bath.
whether you can restore the situation.
Yeah, so you have to go very quickly into the standard model,
yeah,
and then take advantage of the fact that gauge couplings in the standard model are large to reach a thermal distribution fast.
Yeah,
and it's not entirely obvious.
The problem is that to go quickly to the standard model, you need direct couplings of the standard model to the inflationary sector. And mm-hmm. there's been a series of papers that, for instance, if you have like couplings of the Higgs to the inflationary sector, you actually make during preheating instabilities to make the Higgs go more to the unstable regime. Precisely because of the same kind of effects I was discussing yesterday,
mm-hmm.
when you have parametric resonance effects into the Higgs, this forces the Higgs to go into the wrong minimum.
Yeah.
So here what you're assuming is the standard model path appears all of a sudden, but you don't know how.
Yeah.
And then you restore the situation.
Yes.
Well, to make it appear, you need these couplings, which destabilize the Higgs potential, mm-hmm. actually. So
yeah.
This is tricky.
But I think you've also made the standard model very heavy, so how are you supposed to make it?
It's masses of order Hubble in this case, but you go reheat to temperatures, Hubble times m, square root of Hubble times m plane.
At the end of inflation, you've got a bunch of massive things, you know, all the degrees of freedom of masses of all the Hubble scale. So
yeah, so then, okay, so then the question of whether the Hubble inflaton itself is heavy enough to decay into these guys.
Well, the inflaton mass has to be less than the Hubble scale. Well, I guess it is around the Hubble scale.
Yeah, it depends on what potential you draw, but usually around the Hubble scale, yeah. So it is not obvious that it's easy
to do. Yeah, I mean, the mass list, you already ruled out coupling to the mass list in astronomy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So actually, people have worked out in these scenarios like direct coupling of the Higgs non-minimally to gravity or direct mm-hmm. couplings to the inflaton. They make those couplings heavy to prevent the Higgs from making excursion to this minimum. But precisely the strength of those couplings during preheating excite the Higgs to come here. And you see, when you make them light enough, then you have the excursion during inflation and you don't excite it during preheating.
Yeah.
But it seems difficult, you know, if you really want to excite the standard model to find any range of the couplings that does not prevent you from the Higgs coming to this minimum.
Mm-hmm.
In general.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I agree with reheating is gonna be hard here. All right, any other questions?